Ernest Hemingway was both a literary giant and a major celebrity, and his critically acclaimed novels, The Sun Also Rises, A Farewell to Arms, The Old Man and the Sea, were enormously popular with the public. Drawing on new material, Mary Dearborn has written the first full biography of Hemingway in more than 15 years, covering both his writing and his identification with bullfighting, safaris, war reporting, the odd family that he came out of, and the odd family that he wound up producing as well. Ernest Hemingway, a biography, is published by Knopf. I'm very pleased it has brought Mary Dearborn back to our show. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why do you think we continue to be so fascinated by Ernest Hemingway?
Well, I was thinking, as you were talking about it being a long time since the last biography, there's a perception that there have been so many biographies about him, but I don't think it's really that. I think that he's so much with us in our culture as a sort of, I don't like the word icon, but I think that's right for Hemingway, as a sort of icon of masculinity, that he's all around us. You know, there's Hemingway furniture and Hemingway pens and
contests.
Yes, writing short sentences. And look-alike contests.
But is it odd that you're the first one of his biographers who's a woman?
I don't think it's odd. I don't think that there's much in that Hemingway legend to offer a female reader. I think in Hemingway's life itself, there's plenty there. I originally was going to write about the Hemingway family, and I went to Texas to the Harry Ransom Center, where everybody's archives were, and what's in his large archive there are the papers of his mother, Grace. And looking at them and knowing the previous biographies, which were by men, it didn't seem to me they'd even consulted them.
And what a story.
Yeah, well, Grace herself was an original piece of work. She was a fascinating woman. She left an opera career to marry a doctor, Ed Hemingway, and live in a Chicago suburb and raise a family. And she actually gave music lessons, singing voice lessons and piano lessons that brought in more money per month than her husband's doctoring did. But she was far more complicated than that. She had in common an enormous amount in common with Ernest. Mostly, they were both big people, both commanding presences. She had a magnetic appeal. He had a magnetic appeal. They were both the kind of person that when they came into a room, the air was sucked out of it.
He often portrayed her as a controlling woman. Do you think that was fair?
No.
He treated Ernest and his older sister, Marceline, as if they were twins and gave them the same haircuts. She insisted that her daughter be held back a year so that they would be in the same classes at school. You get the feeling that she wished Ernest had been a girl.
Well, I think she did want them to be twins. There was a lot of interesting stuff going on in Grace's head, I think. She dressed them together as girls in dresses, or she dressed them in overalls. And she just liked the idea of them being the same age. But you remember enough of being a child to know that if you were in the same, if you had a sibling in the same grade, that was not fun.
So, luckily, my brother always arrived after me in all the classes, so he got blamed for all the things I had done.
Right.
But then there was another son, Lester. Was he treated in the same way?
No, he was number six. By then, I think Grace had run out of steam a little bit. You know, there were six siblings, and half of them killed themselves eventually, three out of six.
And then there's the other side. There's a woman named Ruth Arnold who became a babysitter for the Hemingway family, and she wound up having an affair with Grace.
Yeah, she was one of Grace's voice students, and so she had sort of, things weren't good at home, and she moved in with the Hemingway family as a kind of au pair and grew up with them, basically. And when she was in her early 20s, she and Grace began a lesbian relationship. And that nearly tore the family apart. There are letters between Grace and her husband then that are so raw and painful to read. Then we don't really know what happened for the next several years. Ruth married briefly, but after Ed Hemingway died in 1928, Ruth and Grace moved in together until Grace's death in 1951. So it seems to have been a long-lived lesbian affair.
Ernest always had many lesbian friends, Gertrude Stein, Sylvia Beach, Janet Flanner, Juna Barnes. Do you think that was related to all of this?
Yeah, really. And he was very close to his sister-in-law, Ginny Pfeiffer, who was second wife, Pauline's sister. And Gertrude Stein, actually, you can see a lot of resemblance to her, to his mother and build, and that same, different kind, but a same, similar charisma and appeal. Yeah, I think, you know, as an infant, as a little boy, and an adolescent, even, he really loved his mother. And that was kind of at the basis of what I find is very endearing lifelong fondness for lesbians.
On the other hand, did he blame his mother for his father's suicide?
He did.
Why? There were so many suicides in this family.
Well, the father was, both Ernest and his father, their depressions were not run-of-the-mill depressions. They were, I don't know if this is a valid term medically, they were psychotic depressions. And in Ernest's case, the way I can best describe it is at the end of his life, he was being taken by a small plane to the Mayo Clinic, and the plane stopped to refuel, and Ernest tried to walk into the propeller. That's like not depression as you or I know it, and his father was the same way at the end.
Well, people said that he, at the end, he suffered from paranoia. But as it turns out, many of the things that he was claiming, like the FBI was tapping his phone and following him, turned out to be true. So,
well, they were true at different parts of his life, but they did. Isn't that strange? But they did turn out to be, or he has a FBI file is what it boils down to. They weren't out there in Ketchum, Idaho, looking at his tax returns, which is what he thought.
Were they concerned because of his connection to Cuba?
That's a good question, and I'm not really sure. And they might well. He was cordial with Castro, and I remember when he first heard the news that the press called on him, and he first said, you know, it's a wonderful thing, or I'm very glad. And his wife made him call the press back and say, no, you know, we're hopeful that, you know, good things will come from this.
My guest is Mary V. Dearborn, who's written a number of biographies. The one we are discussing is her latest, Ernest Hemingway, with a picture of Ernest Hemingway aiming a gun right at us, at the viewer.
Well, that's a long story, and I've heard that people are really. My editor wanted that on the cover. I had no problem with it. It was a little strange, but when I got the galleys, I had a number of friends who objected really strongly. Like, I wouldn't want that on my coffee table. And someone said gun violence to me, which really shook me. And I thought about it. I actually asked my editor for a week to think about it. I thought about it, and he was all about guns. He lived by the gun. He died by the gun. He shot guns. Interestingly, that is actually a Tommy gun. The New York Times had to run a correction of the review that said it was a pistol. And he's on his boat there.
Well, it's hard to tell because we're just looking at the barrel.
Right. But I've heard you can see it. And he had that because he used to actually machine gun sharks on the boat because he hated them getting his catch. But of course, if you machine gun a shark, you just create more blood. It's kind of a disaster.
He wrote about women who looked like men, seemed to be attracted to them. Lady Brett Ashley, the attractive heroine of The Sun Also Rises, wears her hair in an androgynous style, brushed back like a boy. Didn't he sometimes dye and style his hair to match his wife's hair? And his wife, Mary, who seemed to be generally supportive of his sexual fantasies, tried to convince him at that time not to wear earrings, yes. which might have been acceptable more recently.
Well, apparently he did at various times henna his hair. He had a hair fetish. But he was very into blonde hair, and he got very excited writing to his wife, Mary, about the various shades of blonde she could color it. But it went hand in hand with a real interest in androgyny and going beyond gender, so that he and his wife, or in the Garden of Eden, that novel, he and his wife would become beyond gender boundaries, and they could in bed take on different non-traditional sexual roles.
The reason I ask is because, you know, we also associate Hemingway with this very macho style, bullfighting, guns. Would we assume that he might have been overcompensating at some time?
I don't think so. I think that he was, I think that they just happened at the same time, coexisted, I guess I'd say. He had a son. He had a son, Gregory, who is since dead, and Greg was a lifelong transvestite, became, at the end of his life, started surgery, gender surgery.
But he'd had four wives and eight children, so that's another complicated story.
Well, Greg was really, he was a mess. He died in the drunk tank of a women's prison. He was a brilliant man, but that's beyond the scope of my biography, except that Ernest knew about it when Greg was 13, because Ernest and his wife, Mary was missing some underwear, and she fired the Cuban maid. And months later, they found it under Greg's mattress, and he said he was never apologetic for it. And he said it was his, and he kind of played with that all his life, though he did father eight children. But the point is that Ernest, this macho icon, knew about his son for all those years. And that's just, that had to have changed things.
How did Ernest develop his distinctive writing style? Was it, what was more important to his development, his early journalistic career, or the influence of Gertrude Stein?
Oh, well, I think they were both important. But I think when he was 17 and he was thrown into the Kansas City newsroom, Kansas City Star newsroom, he learned a lot from that. He talks a lot about the style sheet they had at the paper that was famous. And one of the ones that I remember, and he always quoted, is don't use adverbs. And I think that gave him an ease in writing. He had to file like 10, 12 stories a day. He was going to the ER, to the police precinct, and he had to produce. And I think journalism helped him.
Although F. Scott Fitzgerald told him to cut out the first chapter of The Sun Also Rises, and that chapter's been made available, and obviously it was good advice.
Yeah, it was terrible. And Scott said, look, all eyes are upon you, Ernest. You know, you can't mess this up. And these pages are so terrible. So Ernest sent them in. He said, the book was already in galleys. And he said, you'll note the first 20 pages are cut. There wasn't anything important in them. Scott agrees with me. Instead of giving Scott any credit.
Tell us about the recent discovery that Hemingway did intelligence work for the Soviet Union during World War II. It was our ally, but did he see any conflict in agreeing to help both the NKVD, which was the forerunner of the KGB, and the U.S. Embassy in Cuba?
Well, I think he was given a code name, Argus. I didn't see the NKVD records, but I gather that that's about all. And then there was a notation that he never did any practical work. I think it was a bit of a misunderstanding on his part and an overstatement on theirs. It was just on the heels of the Spanish Civil War, and he was against Franco fighting fascism. And the Soviets were his on that side then. So Ernest was sympathetic to them, but after the Spanish Civil War, he didn't have a political bone in his body. He didn't know what was happening in the Soviet Union.
Some leftists became disillusioned when they saw the role the Soviet Union played in the Spanish Civil War. It was a problem on both sides. Why didn't Hemingway want his memoir, Movable Feasts, and novels like Garden of Eden to be published during his lifetime?
I think he thought that the Garden of Eden couldn't be published in his lifetime, that it was too sexually explicit. Or he said that in several letters. A Movable Feast, that's a really charming book, really appealing book, but there's a lot of mean stories in there and a lot of outright falsehoods.
So Mary decided to publish them posthumously against his wishes.
Well, he thought they weren't quite done. He had basically found those papers in a trunk that had been in the basement of the Paris Ritz for years and years. And he took them out and kind of assembled this memoir. But I think he was worried that there are a number of codas to that. Well, anyway, he was worried about what his first wife, Hadley, might think, that he was making things up or he was presenting their marriage in too good a light.
Mary V. Dearborn has written about complicated figures like Norman Mailer, Henry Miller, Peggy Guggenheim, and Louise Bryant, now Ernest Hemingway. She will be speaking with her editor, Victoria Wilson, tonight at 7 at the McNally Jackson Bookstore. That's at 52 Prince Street between Lafayette and Mulberry Streets. The book, of course, is published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard.